Hi, y'all. My name's Cricket. I'm an alcoholic.
Cricket.
My sobriety date is October the 19th of 1969, and I'm truly grateful for that. I'm grateful to be here, and I've heard a lot of wonderful speakers. I've got to see some old friends and make some new friends. Life is amazing, and what I'd like for you to do for while I'm behind the podium is what you've started out to do. Please help me celebrate the miracle. Help me celebrate it. And you can do that if you get to know just a little bit about me. I was born into a family that's a little bit unusual. I don't like labels, okay? I don't mind it if you call me a dirty, rotten slut, but don't label me with something I don't understand. You know, I identify with the one, but I don't identify with dysfunctional. So my family was a little different. My mother's full-blooded Black Irish, and she's very superstitious. She believes that one child in every family is born evil, they're born possessed. And you determine it by the weight at birth, and the least one is evil, and I weighed 2.5 pounds. I became evil, and I became possessed. My biological father was a full-blooded Frenchman and very, very, I think he was into service work. He sired 17 children. And the gentleman really believed in the spirit of rotation. He didn't stay with the women that he planted the seed with. He didn't wait to see the results. So I never knew the man. But I know that I'm grateful he did what he did, because it took what he did for me to be here. It really did, and I don't mean that in any dirty way at all. It took everything that occurred for me to be what I am today. My mother was very, very fortunate. She married a man probably in the early 40s, and he had a third grade education. And so we made our living following the crops across the United States. Now please understand, that was a wonderful way of life. It had some privileges and blessings that people just cannot fathom. They just cannot imagine the miracles that I, as a young girl, was exposed to when I had to find gifts because there were none in our home. And so I had to look for the gifts. And let me tell you, one of the gifts that God gave me as a child that I still have as an adult. Most people laugh when I say this, but I mean it with total sincerity. The gift of dirt. As a crop follower, I know that everything that nourishes my physical body comes from the soil of the earth. And no matter how grown up we become or how intelligent or how many things we can clone and do, we can't do dirt. You know, that's God's job. And I defy you to find anything that can taste as good as an apple, as juicy and fresh and clean and pure, that doesn't have its origin in the dirt that my God gave to me as a child. And I still love that dirt. I love looking at the ground and seeing where it cracks. And I know my God hid a potato down there. You know, and if I dig through that crack, there's a potato for Cricket. And if there's more than one, I'll probably share it with you. And if the truth is known, I'll give you at least half of the gift of that potato. Chances are I'll give you more than half. But that's one of the miracles of my life. One of the other miracles of my life is that in our home, because they assigned homes to crop followers back then, and it was one room with a kitchenette, and in our home I had to find a place at a very young age that was safe. I had to find a place where I could go and hide away, where I could disappear, and I found that behind the old wood stove. Now, a lot of you probably never even been around an old wood stove, but they were absolutely amazing. They not only heated the homes, they heated the water for the Saturday night baths. They provided the food. Any hot food was cooked on that old wood stove. And I found out as a little girl that I could crawl behind that old wood stove and nobody else could get to me. Behind that old wood stove, I was safe for the first time in my life. And above and beyond that, behind that old wood stove, I could disappear. Behind that old wood stove, I'd pretend the outside of Cricket away. Because if this looked different, you would allow your children to play with me. If this looked different, you wouldn't be afraid of me. If this looked different, you would not turn your head away in disgust. I understand as an adult you were frightened of crop followers. You were frightened of the lifestyle that we led. And so you were afraid to allow your children to be exposed to us. And we didn't have anything at that time that was contagious. You know, we were just crop followers. But I understand that it was your fear that made you protect your children and separated them from us. That was not necessarily a lonely existence for me, because I also even then understood the gift that that old wood stove gave me. I understood the gift of being able to be alive and not be a part of living. I understood the gift of seeing you without looking at you, of hearing you without listening to you. I understood the gift of disappearing. We went to church twice a year as crop followers. Like most alcoholics, we went to church on a regular basis. Every year, twice a year. We went at Thanksgiving, y'all, and we went at Christmas time, and let me tell you why. Because a minister would stand behind a pulpit, and he would share with his congregation that they should feed those hungry people, and that they should share with the less fortunate, the poor people. And that was us. So we sit on the back row, and we listened to that minister, and I wasn't quite 12 years of age. And let me tell you what I heard the gentleman say. What I heard the gentleman say was, anything that I prayed for in the name of Jesus, I would receive. Now let me tell you what I believed. That anything I prayed for in the name of Jesus, I would receive. There was no reason for me to doubt this man. He was clean. He was behind a pulpit. Everybody was listening to him. Now, I'm not going to tell you that the gentleman was wrong. I don't think he knew what the little girl heard. I don't think he understood my interpretation of his message. I went home, and I thought, anything I pray for in the name of Jesus. Now, we didn't have toys or bicycles or anything like that. I thought, if I could have anything in the world, what would I have? Anything. And let me tell you, what I wanted more than anything in the world was skin that would not repulse you. Because we did not have indoor plumbing or electricity or the things that were proper for good physical hygiene, I had horrible skin. And I went to the mirror in our house, and I looked in the mirror, and I looked at my face, and I studied it. And I found a place on my face that didn't have a zit. And I remember so vividly putting my finger up there and saying, in the name of Jesus, when I waken in the morning, make the rest of my face as clear as this spot is right here. When I woke up in the morning, I was excited. See, I was going to have that skin that women like. I was going to have that skin that men like to look at. I was going to have it because I prayed in the name of Jesus. When I went to the mirror, there was a zit right where I prayed. And see, that said to me, Jesus doesn't like you either. I stayed behind that wood stove, and two of my brothers, my older brothers, were professional men at this time. They were armed robbers. It was a career you really don't put on resumes, and you don't discuss with your neighbors, and you don't want your kid sister telling anybody about. And so they brought me a present. And I was almost 12, and I never will forget it. It came in a brown paper sack, and today I understand it was probably a pint of whiskey. And I remember sitting behind that old wood stove, and I had this snarl. The family was afraid of me because I didn't talk, unless she forced me to. And I was a very, very violent young person. If you cornered me, if you cornered me, I didn't start things, but I never backed down from one. I still don't. But they reached behind that stove, and everything in me bristled, and my nails kind of came up, and they said, "We got you something if you don't tell what we're doing," because they had hid their guns and the money from the robberies. One of their hiding places was behind the wood stove. And they handed me that sack, and when they walked away, I sat behind that wood stove, and I remember opening that bottle up, and I remember putting it to my mouth and drinking my first drink of alcohol. And I remember how that whiskey burned. I don't remember the taste, I remember the burn. That whiskey burned my throat, it burned my chest, it burned all the way down, it burned all the way back up again, and it burned all the way back down again. And you know what? I didn't stop until the bottle was empty. That is the way I drank until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at 28 years of age. I never stopped as long as there was a corner in that bottle. I couldn't. I just could not. I went back before God with a prayer, and it was something to the effect, almost absolutely, "Dear God, sir, my name's Cricket, and I don't believe in you. I don't believe in cleanliness. I don't believe in family, and I don't believe in goodness. But just in case you are, sir, this is my very last prayer to you. Help me to never feel again. And big boy, I don't want any favors from you. I don't even want to feel good." By the time I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, that prayer had been answered in its entirety. I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous completely incapable of feeling any normal type of human emotion, and I stayed that way for several years in the Fellowship of AA without taking a drink of anything containing alcohol. At the age of 12, I left home. I started living on the streets of Denver, Colorado, because that is where we had wound up after picking the crops. The state of Colorado interfered. They said, "Young girls do not live the lifestyle I was living." They took me from the streets of Denver. They said I was incorrigible, and I didn't know what they were saying. That was a label. And they took me to this wonderful place in the mountains in Morrison, Colorado, called a reform school. It was absolutely, I was so blessed. There was one person to a bed, and I'd never had that experience. Two sheets on every bed, and I'd never had that experience. Indoor toilet, big old white bathtub, three meals a day. I liked being punished. It was absolutely wonderful. You know, I left the Colorado State Reform School a year later. I guess I became corrigible. They sent me right back to the streets of Denver, Colorado, and I did whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. I stayed on the streets of Denver, Colorado. At the age of 16, the state of Colorado interfered one more time. They did not recognize teenage alcoholism in the middle 50s, but they didn't like the things that I was doing on the streets. They took me from the streets of Denver, Colorado, to the Colorado State Insane Asylum in Pueblo, Colorado. They had to diagnose me. So they diagnosed me as schizophrenic with paranoid reaction with psychotic tendencies, and I thought, hot dog, I'm only 16. Labels. I was several years sober, and my sponsor told me, "Ah, honey, schizophrenic means you're two-faced, and you are. Paranoid means people talk behind your back, and they do. And psychotic means you'd rather kill them than yourself, and I still would." So I guess the label fit to make me not be those things. They gave me 10 milligrams of Valium, 25 milligrams of Librium, and 50 milligrams of Thorazine four times a day. The compulsion to drink was removed. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, they strapped me to a gurney and they held me from my shoulders down to my ankles, and they administered electric shock treatments. And this is back in the middle 50s. 3 times a week for 18 months, I was wheeled into the electric shock treatment room. And I lay on this gurney while these people held me, and they put a big roll of gauze in my mouth. They put gooey stuff on my temples and a leather band around my forehead. And the psychiatrist, the intelligent one between he and I, would reach his hand to this electrical lever behind me and look into my eyes, which was the only part of my body at that time I had any control over, was my eyelids. He'd look into my eyes and say, "Are you scared?" And I'd think, number one, I can't answer you. Why are you asking a question? Number two, you lay here and know that just that quick, your intellectual hand is going to pull that electric lever, and my body is going to go into grand mal seizures, sometimes have to be medically resuscitated, and I'm not going to remember nothing. I'm not going to be able to walk right, talk right, or know anything for a time. And you ask me if I'm scared. How much education did it take for you to get that smart, sir? Because yes, I was as terrified of my last shock treatment as I was of my very first shock treatment. Right before I turned 18 years of age, in fact, almost a week to the day, I was released from the Colorado State Insane Asylum. And I don't know if I'd been cured or what. I know I weighed 300 pounds. I couldn't get out into the sunshine because of the effects of the Thorazine. My chin rested on my shoulder. It was as if I'd had a shock. I had brain damage from the shock treatments. I couldn't walk right any longer. I couldn't speak hardly at all. I had that guttural speech. I was one of those that if you were around me, you would move away from me. And see, if I see a man or a woman like I used to be, I ask God, God, clean me up enough inside that I can receive the gift of sitting by them. Because sometimes all it takes is a touch on the shoulder. Just know that I'm still in here. This is just what you see. Inside of me, I'm still there. I'm still there. You may not be able to see me, but I'm still there, y'all. And so I'm blessed God allows me on occasion to meet somebody just like I was. And I'm so grateful for that today. The reason I'm grateful I was released a week early is because the state had authorized a sterilization of my body. They did not want me to produce another cricket. With several years of continuous sobriety, God allowed my body to house a child. You know, I was sober 7 or 8 years, and the state didn't have their way. God had his way. And inside of me, from right under my breast all the way down, it became a home. And inside of me, God did whatever God knows how to do. And my body did what my body knew how to do without any instructions on my part. And that home housed a child for 9 months. And that child got everything it needed to come into this world from me. From the drunken slut on the street with several years of sobriety, I got to do that. And I am grateful for that gift. When I left that Colorado State Insane Asylum, they put me on a Greyhound bus in one of the old shirtwaist dresses with the brown lace-up shoes and the little white fold-down anklets on my way back to Denver, Colorado. I got off of that Greyhound bus and I found a beer joint and I crawled up on a bar stool determined to die a drunken woman on the street of any city, anywhere. My prayer had been answered. I was incapable of feeling anything. I stayed in this beer joint day after day, night after night. minding my own business, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. Eventually, I could hold my head erect. Eventually, I could speak words that you could understand again. Eventually, I lost weight. Eventually, I could walk right again. And I loved my beer joints. I'm not a bar room drinker. I'm not a club drinker. I'm not a housewife drinker. I'm a beer joint woman. You know, I know what it is. And let me tell you, this is another miracle. And if it offends you, I'm so sorry. I know what it's like to dig in a garbage barrel and find a piece of cantaloupe and scrape the maggots off of it. Behold the beauty of that cantaloupe and be grateful for the gift of it. When I tell you I was not a housewife, I wasn't. I lived on the street. And I know the beauty of being able to do those kind of things. I know how to watch where the pigeons roost because I know that they've got enough sense to be where it's warmest in the winter and coolest in the summer. I know how to find that safe place. I know how to find the gifts. I know how to look for them. And I know how to accept them. As I stayed in that beer joint day after day, and I'd go to different cities in different states, and I'd come back, I wound up back in Denver, Colorado. I wound up back in Denver, Colorado in the early part of 1969. Now, I know that most people in Alcoholics Anonymous have had DWIs. And I used to think when I was a newcomer, I never drove. I don't have a DWI. But then my sister reminded me that in St. Joe, Missouri, I got drunk and I got in a shopping cart on a hill. Now let me tell you, shopping carts going downhill build up momentum. They have no braking system and no steering. By the time the cops stopped me at the bottom of this hill, they issued me a ticket for driving a non-motorized vehicle under the influence of alcohol. So y'all, I qualify. But when I wound back up in Denver, Colorado, I found a beer joint. My beer joints are the kind that have the old red stools. Usually they're red. And they've got that stuff that comes up from the tears in them. And they take that gray tape and they tape them together. You know, that's my beer joint. Them eggs floating in that purple stuff in a jar. That's my beer joint. In all the years I drank, I never saw anybody buy an egg. But the eggs stay there. And if you go in today, they'll sell you one of them eggs. I don't advise putting it in your mouth, but you can buy an egg. And I don't know why they're there. Never did figure out why they were there. But in my beer joint, I had my corner. And my corner was at the very end of the bar for several reasons. I didn't like anybody, and I didn't want anybody near me. I still sit in corners for different reasons today. I sit in corners because they're comfortable for me. I can put my feet up under me, and I'm not offending other people. I can sit in corners and still go behind the wood stove that God still has for me, and it's in His arms. I can crawl right up in there in this room of all of you and know that gift of God's love. And I still do that today. When I sat in that beer joint, the most amazing part of the day was about 5:15 in the afternoon when some of your husbands would come in to patronize. They were so precious. I don't know how many Al-Anons are here that lived through active alcoholism with their mates, but let me tell you something about them. They didn't want to hurt you. They didn't want to lie to you. They didn't want to cheat on you. But because of the disease of alcoholism, they couldn't stop themselves. And I benefited from their disease. They'd come in about 5:15 in the afternoon, and that flash of light interfered with my darkness. And they'd scope the bar. And they'd see a woman sitting by herself. And they had such class. They'd walk down that bar and they'd leave a stool between me and them. You know, that was the only class they had. After that, it was gone. And they were so cute. because they'd look at me and they'd give those sounds that only alcoholic men can make. You know, a sigh that comes from somewhere deep inside of them. Just a groan. And you look at them and you say, what's the matter? And they say, oh, lady, all I do is work all day. Want to take care of the wife and kids. I want to stop off and have a couple drinks. And when I go home, she's going to be nyet, 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 nyet. And you look at him and you say, you know what? If I had a man like you, I'd know how to treat him. Oh, and then your precious husband would say to me, would you like a drink? And in my head, I'd say, yes, fool. You have nothing else I want. Now, let me tell you, I came into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and learned some things before and after meetings. I heard men say in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that if you put a sack over a woman's head, we're all the same. And I had to process that. You know, I was a working woman. Every man I ever knew went by the name of John. And I'm here to tell you, put a sack over your heads and you're all the same. And very seldom did I give freebies and still don't. You know? But let me tell you the neat part about that deal. Those men went home to you. You are the people that kept the fire in their heart going. You are the men and women married to any alcoholic that practice the disease of alcoholism. You are the people that became their wood stove. Did they mean to hurt you? Nah. Did they want to hurt you? No. Are they sorry? If they're not, they're not working a very healthy program. When I was sitting there one Saturday night, this man and his wife entered. His name was Harry. And he came up to me and he said, Cricket, my wife and I have watched you for several months. And I said, and? He said, we think you have a problem drinking. I said, let me tell you something, big boy. I don't have a problem drinking. He said, Cricket, you go places you don't remember going. And I thought, so? You say things you don't remember saying. And I thought, so? And he said, and you fight over things, anything. And I thought, so? He said, Cricket, see, I've got 72 felonies, but I can't be prosecuted because the people that write the laws are more intelligent than I am. So they release me from the mental institution with a lifetime temporary release, which means I'm not accountable if I commit murder. Oh, what a blessing. You know, it's a good thing I got sober and got a sponsor who said, you're not going to use that. Some of you are real lucky because I don't like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't love everybody in AA. There's some real jerks, male and female. I see them on a daily basis. There are people that take the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and turn them into a lethal weapon to get their own way. You know, they will twist them and screw with them and do totally what they're not designed for. They're to be a tool, not a weapon. And I think, oh my gosh. So some of you should be real grateful that my sponsor didn't allow me to use my mental illness as an excuse. I'll tell you what, though. That man and his wife said to me, let's make a deal. If you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with us tomorrow night, and we find out you don't have a problem drinking, we'll leave you alone. And I said, okay, big boy. He said, now when you waken in the morning, don't take a drink of anything containing alcohol. I said, okay, big boy. I weighed 78 pounds. The teeth was rotted out of my head. And I went to one of my sister's houses. Let me tell you, I was one of those people that took dares. Other people vicariously lived out their own insanity through me. Get Cricket to do it. She'll do anything. And I would, because I didn't want to look weak in front of anybody. And I felt like he challenged me to go to AA. I went to my sister's home that night, and I woke up the next morning and did the only thing I knew how to do, the thing I'd done every day for as long as I could. I reached the side of my bed, and I brought up my bottle of whiskey. And that morning, I could not take that drink. Today, I understand that was another gift, another miracle. I got deathly ill not drinking. Don't misunderstand me. I had the dry heaves so bad I thought I was going to die. I had audible hallucinations. I had visual hallucinations. I went into seizures at meetings. I did the whole thing. And those were gifts. Those were gifts because they made me hang on and hang on and hang on until the day you would kick me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became a good member of that group. They started having emergency group consciences, emergency steering committees, studying the traditions, because I sat on the back row. And when I was a newcomer and they passed the little wicker baskets, they said, if you've got it, put it in. If you need it, take it out. And I took all their money. They said, take what you need now, what you don't need now, come back and get later. And I stole the office equipment, took it to the pawn shop and hawked it. And I came back to get what I needed later, which was quarters out of the Coke machine and a soft drink. I came back with my crowbar, and I've developed some long-term sobriety, like 3 weeks. And I'm there with my crowbar to break into the Coke machine, and I get attacked by a bunch of the AA men. None of the women would come with them. And I get these men approach me, and they said, Cricket, we're not going to tolerate your behavior anymore. And I thought, thank God. As soon as AA kicks me out, I don't look weak to Harry, and I can go back out and die a drunken woman on the street of some city, somewhere. And they said they wanted to kick me out, and I said, okay. And they said, but our traditions won't allow us to. And I thought, oh my God. See, they used him as a tool, not a weapon. They used him as a tool. They said, our traditions will not allow us to, as long as you have a desire to stay sober. Well, I had to fake a desire because else I'm going to lose this dare with Harry. So I'm faking this desire, and they said, but from now on, you will be escorted in and out of the AA meetings. See, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with two prejudices. I did not like red-haired women, so I hit them. Now I sponsor three wonderful red-haired women. I did not like lesbians. Now I sponsor some wonderful lesbian people, and I sponsor a couple of the gay men. That's God doing for Cricket what she could not do for herself. However, at my very first AA meeting when I walked in, a red-headed lady came walking up to me, and she said, hi, my name's Sharon. Are you an alkie? And I knocked her on her rear end. So when they had this meeting with me by the Coke machine, they said I had to bring back the money I panhandled. I could not hit people I didn't like. I could no longer turn over tables during discussion meetings. I had to take my price list back that my sister had given me to pass out to the male members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of them used it. And they had two men that escorted me in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 6 months of my sobriety. And they sat beside me during the meeting. They walked me out after the meeting. With 6 months of continuous sobriety, the narcotics division of the Denver Police Force told me I had to move out of Denver, and I thought, I haven't done anything. And I said, okay, big boys, on three conditions. I want a high school diploma because I've got 4 years of formal education. And I want a case of really soft toilet paper because they told me I was moving to Texas. And I wanted some soft toilet paper because I'd heard about the corn cobs, you know. And I'm an outhouse veteran. I wasn't necessarily used to toilet paper, but I was very unfamiliar with corn cobs. And so I want toilet paper, a high school diploma, and a car with a driver's license. And they said, okay, Cricket. They took me and this lady read me questions for about 30 minutes and said, congratulations, you passed your GED. You have a high school diploma, a gift. They bought me a case of toilet paper. They bought me a 58 Rambler station wagon. It had three pedals. I got two legs. You talk about getting to know something. It didn't happen. I went in day after day to take a driving test. Day after day after day after day. Finally, I went in and that old bleeding deacon came up there because all the men were refusing to get in the car with me. He said, "Don't worry about it, fellows, I will." And we went out and got in that 58 Rambler station wagon. He said, "Cricket, crank it up." And I did. He said, "Congratulations, you passed your driving test." My sister, my high school diploma, that 58 Rambler, my driver's license, left Denver, Colorado to head towards Fort Worth, Texas. I knew how to use first gear and third gear. And we got there. And I don't know how many of y'all have ever been to Fort Worth, Texas, but it's long. And we get wound up on this street called Lancaster. And it just goes and goes and goes. And I told my sister, "Sis, we need to find a place to live." She said, "I know." About 30 minutes later, she glances over to her left and she says, "Sis, look, that little beer joint's called the Lucky Lady." I said, "This is our neighborhood. Because if Texans use corn cobs, they don't know about traditions, they'll kick me out." And she said, "Okay." And we found a little one-room apartment above a little grocery store right next door to the Lucky Lady beer joint. I did the next thing I was told to do. I went down and I called a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was on the far southwest of Fort Worth. I was on the far east side. And when the man answered the phone, I asked for directions. He said, "Do you need a ride?" I said, "Is that what I ask you for, fool? I need directions to your group. Can you handle that?" And he gave me directions, and I hitchhiked from the far east side to the far southwest side of Fort Worth and walked into my first Texas AA meeting, and a redheaded lady came walking up to me. And she said, "Hello, darling. My name's Nadine." And I knocked her on her rear end. It wasn't long. I became good for that group. They installed a floor safe to protect their money. I learned about Al-Anons at that group before and after the meeting. I learned how sick you were, that you're sicker than we are. You don't like them drunk. You don't like them sober. You don't like them with those women, and you don't like them with the AA women. It's just their whole life is just nat, 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 nat. And I thought, poor men. Somebody needs to let these Al-Anons know how sick they are. And so my first active service work was to go to the hospital and steal the intensive care unit sign and take it back to the AA group and nail it on the Al-Anon room door. We allowed our Al-Anons to meet once a week, and they had to walk through our meeting room at 8 o'clock on Thursday night. Well, the door's open till 8. The minute the door closes, all of the AA people see that sign and they turn around and look at me. I got looked at more in my first few years of sobriety than anybody in our group. Well, the late Al-Anon came in, y'all. She was too cute. When she saw the sign, the little back of her ears turned purple. She didn't say a word. She went in the room and shut the door. And 2 seconds later, the Al-Anon came out. Now, the Al-Anon was something to behold. Her little nostrils were flared, the veins in her temples protruded, and she had perfect diction. She said, "Who hung that sign?" And I said, "Lady, I did that." And she said, "Oh, it's okay, Cricket." See, she was scared of me. Don't let anybody tell you there's anything dumb about an Al-Anon. There's not a program that I respect more than the Al-Anon and Alateen family programs. Because what we did to them is not, we can't undo it. We can be forgiven, but we can't make it right. Our wrongs cannot be made right. They can only be forgiven. And for the men and women of Al-Anon and Alateen, my hat's not off to you, but my heart's open to you. Because I know what I was and what I did to people. And for you to have the courage and love to take the program that you've been offered through Ann and Lois and put it into application in your daily life so that at some point in your heart you could forgive us for our wrongdoings. My heart is open to you, and I'm sincerely grateful for that gift. that those women gave to you for us. I stayed at that group for about 7 years. And somebody coughed a resentment, they went in, they torched it. I didn't do it. There's still people that think I did. I've never set an AA group on fire yet. The group moved. The group moved, but I couldn't make the move with it. See, I just didn't fit in when they moved. And there was another group I'd heard about called Harbor. And I was told I'd never fit in at Harbor. Those people would never accept me. The women at Harbor were ladies. They would never accept a woman like me. The men were professional businessmen. They would never accept a woman like me. See, I'd never been married before I came into AA. But I've had 12 husbands in Alcoholics Anonymous. Two of them were my own. But I couldn't go when this group moved. So I went down to Harbor Group, y'all. And I walked into my first Harbor AA meeting. And a red-headed lady came walking up to me. And she stood way high. And she looked at me and she said, "Cricket, my name's Betty G. And I'm really scared of you." And I said, "Okay." And she said, "But I'm going to be your sponsor." I said, "Wait a minute, lady. I've been sober several years." She said, "I'm not taking anything away from that. I'll make a deal with you. Let's go into the office here at Harbor Club. And if I think you understand the program of recovery as outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll leave you alone." I said, "Okay, woman." We went into the office at Harbor, and Betty G. opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she handed it across the desk to me, and she said, "Please read me the first portion of chapter 5. And I started reading to Betty G. the first portion of chapter 5. "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not." And I read all the way through the ABCs. Betty G. reached across the desk and she took the big book of AA out of my hand and she said, "Cricket, darling, you can't read." And it was like I'd been gut kicked one more time. I said, "Excuse me, woman, I just read you the first portion of chapter 5. She said, "No, I had it open on chapter 3. You've heard it read day after day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. You have it memorized." And I looked at her and I said, "Woman, what are you going to do with that information?" The gift. The secret was found out. The gift. She took me to Texas Christian University. I sat with 9 and 10-year-old children in a thing called remedial reading in my late 30s. See, I can pick up this book. I can read it. And it's not just a book. Those are not just words. Those letters come together and they make something that goes through my eyes, behind my eyes, all the way down into my heart, and it makes a picture that goes flash, flash, flash. And it's so exciting. It's a gift. Those men and women that would never accept a woman like me set me in the coffee room of their club room. And they taught me how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. They changed the way I dress. I had to get a legal job. That's amazing. You know, it's amazing. I am so proud that the government allows me to pay taxes. And I mean that sincerely. That's a gift for me. My sponsor became very, very ill, and we knew she was dying. And I knew what my job was. See, I can't owe anybody. My job was to pay her back. And so I'd go by her home 3 times a day and start doing the things that she needed to have done for her. And I did this. Now let me tell you what my sponsor was like. I'm a crop follower's kid. She was a judge's daughter. I had a 4th grade education, she had a PhD. I went to reform school, she went to finishing school. I went to the state insane asylum. She carried the message to the state insane asylum. You know, normally people that would not mix. And this woman loved me into life. This was just existing. My sponsor and those men and women loved me into life. And I was so blessed. I had the gift of giving back to her. And she began me on this journey. She began me with many years of continuous sobriety. I got to go buck naked before God spiritually and admit that I was alcoholic, that my life was unmanageable. The thrill of coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Making a decision. Not just a hunch, not just a guess. See, I'm one of those, if I make a commitment, it's a commitment. It is a commitment. And I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of my God as I understood Him. I like mathematics. I'm not real good. When my daughter was in grade school and junior high, I got to learn a little bit about fractions. And you know, that's what the steps are for me. Steps 1, 2, and 3 got me okay with God. Steps 4, 5, 6 got me okay with me. And 7 got me okay with me. Steps 8 and 9 got me okay with you. Steps 10, 11, and 12 keep me okay with God, myself, and you. And that's kind of the way I have to do my life, you know. This woman made me make amends. She made me do the whole thing. She cut me no slack. I was at her house, oh, I guess 12 years ago now, on a Valentine's Day. And I took her everything she wanted for Valentine's Day. I did everything she asked for Valentine's Day. And I looked down into her eyes when I left. And she had a tear come out the corner of her eye, and it went down those cracks. See, God is so very gentle with His magnificent fingernails. He etches our skin as we age. And it's painless. We don't feel it. It just happens. And I looked into the crevices of her skin, and they were so absolutely amazingly beautiful. And I saw a tear, a gift. And I thought, where's it come from? And I tried to trace it back to the source. The tears of the people that cry for us don't come from the eyes. That's just the outlet. They come from the source of the heart, way down deep inside. And she looked into my eyes, and I don't know how many times she'd said it before. And she said, Cricket, darling, you know I love you. For the very first time, I looked into the eyes of a human being, and I said, I love you too. See, shortly before that night, I'd gone back to God with a prayer. Dear God, sir, my name's Cricket, and I believe in you today. And I do believe in cleanliness. I do believe in family because I have a daughter. And I do believe in goodness. But, sir, I'm still not able to feel. May I rescind that prayer I said to you as a little girl and ask you to help me feel again? Because, sir, I go to those AA meetings. And when those people hold my hands, I have to go and wash them off. And I don't care if they die drunk. I don't care what happens in their family life. If it's possible, sir, help me to feel again. And I know I may even have to feel bad. That prayer was answered in its entirety also. When I said goodnight to my sponsor and told her I loved her, I did what I was supposed to do the rest of the evening, and I went home. My daughter and I woke the next morning, and I went to my sponsor's home to make her breakfast. And I found her in her bathroom floor dead. You know, when's the time to tell your sponsor thank you? Maybe today. When's the time to tell your daughter, your son, your wife, your friends, somebody you love them? Maybe today. Maybe today's the day. When's the time to try to right a wrong? And if it can't be righted, ask for forgiveness? Maybe today. I don't know about y'all, but you know, as a crop follower, I know that the row starts somewhere and it ends somewhere. It just does. We used to keep a little jug of water at the end of the row. And I found out as a child, if I kept looking ahead to that jug of water, the row seemed to go on forever. Forever. And even in sobriety, I have enough sense to know I have to look behind me. I have to look behind me, y'all. The steps tell us to look backwards, too. How can we write it if we don't acknowledge it? And if we can acknowledge it, means we have already done it. So I look behind me to see how far I've came. And when I can see how far I've came, when I look ahead, it's not so long. It's just not so long when I get the gift of looking behind and ahead and at both sides. I looked down at my sponsor and I knelt down beside her. And my first thought was, oh, Betty. Because see, this woman had taken a nothing and turned it into a woman that will not steal from you. I won't lie to you. I won't commit adultery. I'm not going to hit you unless you hit me first. I'm not going to abuse you. I'm not going to assassinate your character behind your back. I'm not going to talk about the people in the program that are out doing the deal, that carry the message, that hold offices, that hold positions. My attitude is we're all different. So it doesn't matter. I don't know whether you're right or I'm right. We're different. And when I do different, I can do that without condemnation. If I do right or wrong, there's condemnation. So I choose to just do different. They took my sponsor away. And as they took her away, I will share with you the miracle of a little girl following crops. I was just a bit of a thing. And crop followers sing a lot of spiritual songs as the sun starts going down. And there was a man that befriended me as a six-year-old girl, and his name was Ike. And he had this magnificent head of hair. He'd allow me to put my hands on it and push it down, and it'd bounce back up. And I'd push it down and bounce back up. And Ike had teeth as white as piano keys. And he had skin as dark as mahogany. And the satin warmth of his soul. He'd look down at me as a little girl and he'd say, oh, little pale one, someday you're going to mount up with the wings of an eagle. And I thought when they had my sponsor, when I knelt beside her, what do I do? And I knew what I had to do. I had a commitment to my sponsor. I had to pick up the spiritual toolkit that those people laid at my feet. And I had to open that box up and I start having to use it on a daily basis. Because of men and women like you, my daughter never laid in the floor and saw a foot coming upside of her head. I've never called my daughter a dirty name. She's never been grabbed by the front of her shirt and hit over and over right smack dab in her mouth. Never. Not because I didn't want to, but because you taught me how not to. Because I called my sponsor and I said, come and get her because I'm going to hurt her and I won't be able to stop me. And the Al-Anons and the alcoholics came to my home and they said, when that monster comes alive, you remove you from the situation. Put that person or that child out of sight and you go outside until God can soothe that savage beast. And I'd go outside and I did like we did when we followed crops. And I'd sing the old spirituals over and over and over. And eventually that beast went back to sleep. It's still alive. It's still right there. And it's so hungry. It wants me to nurture it and feed it so I can hate you. So I can find fault with you. So I can tear AA apart. So I can die a drunken woman on the street somewhere. But I refuse to give it the sustenance that it needs to come back into being. When they took my sponsor away and they put her in that box, I knew what she had truly given me. I knew the gifts. Every day since that day, I have tried to apply them. A few years ago, two or three now, I was diagnosed with terminal cancer. I have about 26, 27 tumors inside of my stomach. I can't eat very much. So I don't go to dinner with people very often. I have quite a bit of pain, and that's okay too. Let me tell you why it's okay. Not because I'm a martyr, but because it's a gift. I know what I would have done 2 or 3 years ago with what I have to live with today. And I would have died a drunken woman on the streets of some city, somewhere. And if God didn't think I was capable of doing the journey, he wouldn't have given me the roadmap. And see, I believe with every fiber of my being that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous was written for me. I think they would have written that if I was the only person that ever sobered up, because it gives me clear-cut directions on how I could recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, y'all. I'm having to leave home. With all those years of sobriety, I was able to purchase a home in Fort Worth, Texas, right in the middle of Mexican gang town. It's bright yellow. It has 16 windows. No two rooms are the same color. You know, I've got an orange room, a green room, a purple room, a blue room, a yellow room. So exciting. Kids have learned to ride their bicycles on my hardwood floors. What a gift. I never had a bicycle. They can learn to ride it on my floor and I can pick them up. The same woman that had to call her sponsor and say, come and get my daughter because I'm going to hit her and I'm not going to be able to stop me. That same woman can pick up a child when it falls and say, shh, shh, it's okay. I'm the same woman. Little Mexican boys and girls sit on my couch and they look at a letter and I say, that letter's name is A. That's what its name is. And it doesn't make very many sounds. It either makes the sound A, A, or ah. That's all it's ever going to make. And to see them, when they can get that letter to make a word, when you put up B-A-T, and they go, Miss Cricket, that's a bat. That's a bat. And you see the picture. And you see them go off to school. And then when report card time comes, they come running across my front yard and they say, Miss Cricket, you and me made an A. Miss Cricket, you and me made a C. See, what a gift. What a gift. Because of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because of that. I had to sell this home. I'm moving to Ringwood, Illinois, with a woman that cares very, very much about me. She's become a very, very dear friend. She's writing my life story. And it's interesting to read it because you see it. You know, she writes to where you see it. She's providing me with a home. The men and women at Harbor that would never accept a woman like me, 2 years ago, as an outside AA thing, had a celebration of my life. They raised $10,000 to give me enough money to buy a new medication called Gleevec that has kept me alive. Is that amazing? Is that a gift? Tell me. You know? See, I'm coming down that row and I look behind me and I only have this far to go now. This far to go. There's still some weeds to pick. There's still some things I got to get done. Let me tell you about some of my heroes, the men and women I sponsor that trust that I love them enough to guide them in the right direction, whether they want it or not. Heroes. Friends that love me. Heroes. An ex-husband and his wife that try to do anything in their power to help me today. Heroes, a 25-year-old girl child that housed inside of me for 9 months and then lived the first 21 years of her life in that yellow house on the corner, 18 years until the day she married. and went and got married and had her own home. And a year later, she gave birth to a son, a boy child. God knew she was good enough and clean enough to do that. 2 years ago, she went through a divorce. This wonderful 25-year-old woman works a job every day. She's intelligent. She's clean on the outside. She's not going to die a drunken woman on the street of any city anywhere. She's my child. She has a high school diploma. You know, she's my child. Tell me about the gifts and the heroes. The heroes are a man that'll sit back there day after day and check our badges and make sure we're not bringing coffee in here. That's a hero. Do you want to do it? Does anybody in this room want to take Thomas's job? Don't think so. The heroes are the men and women who pick up cigarette butts outside. Those are heroes. Men and women who make a trip to the airport. The speakers that you've had all weekend, heroes. And Bob, who sits beside me, because you know why? He likes me. It's just the truth. Bob likes me. He likes what's inside of me and what's here. A hero. Celebrate with me the miracle and know that you can't lead where you don't go. You can't teach what you don't know. You can't be what you are not. You can't give what you ain't got. As I leave, I've asked my daughter at that final thing that they do for people to dedicate to the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. Words from a song. You were my voice when I could not speak. You were my strength when I was weak. You held me up when I could not stand. I lost my faith. You gave it back to me. I'm everything I am, and you know why. Because beginning with Dr. Bob and Bill W., I am what I am because you loved me. Thank you.